Let's Talk Land, a weekly land education talk show devoted to learning about land and farms, buying and selling, ownership, and especially for real estate agent and realtors. Learn from the experts. Free land education. Hi, my name's Lou Jewell. I'm an accredited land consultant with United Country Real Estate, Sutton Properties, our new company name, along with my co-host, Teresa Martin, who's one of our agents. Hey, Teresa.
Hi, Lou.
How are you today?
I'm doing well.
Good for you. We got a great guest today. Buying and selling homes, land or farms, or want to auction your property in Western Piedmont, North Carolina, or Southern Virginia, give us a shout. We'll help you out. Our new office is at 102 East Main Street next to BB&T Bank in downtown Pilot Mountain, North Carolina. Please make a note of our changes. Our new company website is www.allsuttonproperties.com. That's A-L-L-S-U-T-T-O-N properties.com. And just a program note, Dr. Barbie's Ask the Doctor show will follow this show and will air at 10 a.m. So make sure you stay tuned. Dr. Barbie always has something good to talk about. Help you out. Our guest today is Brian Meese. Welcome, Brian.
Welcome, Lou. Welcome, Teresa.
You're from Bend, Oregon, is that right?
Yes, my home is out of Bend, Oregon, and I represent buyers and sellers throughout Eastern and Central Oregon.
How long have you been in the real estate business?
I've been licensed here since 1981, so a little over 38 years, and that was after playing 10 years a corporation around the Western United States.
Wow. You enjoy it, I'm sure, like we all do. Brian is also an accredited land consultant like myself. Just to let you know that we have organizations that's part of the National Association of Realtors. We're a little over 1.3 million strong. And in these groups, we have an organization for commercial real estate, for property management, international real estate. There's quite a few of them. But the one that we're a member of is the Realtors Land Institute. And I believe we're about 76 years old. And we have about 1,300 members nationwide. We're one of the smallest groups in NAR, but we are the land experts, and our accreditation is called Accredited Land Consultant. That's where the ALC comes from. And, Brian, you also have the CCIM designation as well as the GRI. The CCIM is for commercial brokers that want to specialize in commercial real estate, and GRI is for the Graduate Realtors Institute, which is an advanced study for residential, is that correct?
That's correct.
And you're the principal broker of a REMAX Key Properties in Bend, Oregon. And you are also the president of the Realtors Land Institute's chapter, the Pacific Northwest Realtors Land Institute chapter. I've been the president of our chapter twice since I joined in 1998, and also teach the RLI two-day tested Land 101 introduction course. I've been doing that all over the country and enjoy doing it. Hope to get invited maybe by your chapter to come visit you guys someday.
That would be enjoyable.
You got a nice award. We give these awards out. Realtors and the Oregon Association of Realtors, that's for the whole state, in 2008 as Realtor of the Year. Congratulations. That's quite an honor.
Thank you very much. Predominantly comes from years of working in the property rights and land use arena on behalf of my clients and other brokers throughout the state.
Yeah, we want to talk about that as we get into the show. How many states are in your chapter?
So today, there are six states in the Pacific Northwest chapter: Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, and California.
How many members?
When you talk about the Pacific Northwest, Nevada and California don't really fit in.
Right.
So we're talking with National about that issue now. So we have about 110 members total between the six states.
Right.
And one of our objectives over the course of 2020 will be to build our membership.
Absolutely. We're working on ours as well. We've had over 300 members at one time. I think we're down about 38 right now. So we got a lot of work to get back to where we were, but that's okay. You went to, in 71, you graduated from Oregon State University with a BS degree in engineering. And then from 71 to 74, you went to Portland State University and got your MBA study. So that was your foundation. Your great-grandparents, it's interesting, homesteaded on the John Day River in North Gillam County in Oregon in the late 1880s. Tell us a little bit about that homestead program. It's kind of interesting.
So back in the days, you could come into Oregon and you could claim your 320-acre plot. My family started with a couple of plots and started raising wheat and cattle up in north central Oregon. And that's the countryside of my life. I also graduated from Lake Oswego High School, which is near Portland, which gives me a diversity and thus the reason for being a commercial guy and a rural land guy.
Excellent. That's a great background. But you specialize in sales and marketing of ranches, land, recreational investment, real estate throughout central and eastern Oregon. You also provide general and land use real estate consulting services. Tell us about your consulting service and mediation.
So most of it has been in relationship to our realtor organizations. I am a trained mediator, so I mediate realtor problems and construction issues that rise when maybe everything doesn't go perfect. I've spent many, many hours in public hearings trying to understand Oregon's land use laws. So it's given me the basis to help people other than just buying and selling real estate.
So you're on the professional standards in your MLS group? Have you been on that?
Yeah, I've been the chief of our professional standards group many times over. Spent years as part of that organization within the Central Oregon Association of Realtors.
Right. I had the privilege of representing the Realtors Land Institute on the National Professional Board back in 2008, and I was the one who instigated land as a specialty to the board. And in 2010, the NAR Board of Directors recognized land as a specialty like commercial property management, international real estate appraisal, and so on, and residential, and approved it in San Diego at the national convention. I was there, and so I'm quite proud of that contribution to our organization. It's in our Code of Ethics, Article 11. We're self-policing. The Realtors, we're the oldest or second oldest organization in the country that is self-policing. So we're proud of our Code of Ethics, and now we have to take it, I believe, what, every 2 years, a class on it just to keep us posted and keep us doing the right things for the public out there. One of the things that Therese and I was really interested in was your background in the land use and property rights. You know, that's throughout the country. It's not just in Oregon. Every state has land use programs and property rights. Just a bit that I found, the National Association of Realtors recognizes it as the freedom to buy and sell and to utilize property is protected in the Fifth Amendment, underlies all real estate transactions and markets. Any restrictions placed on a property owner from realizing the highest and best use of that property hinders the economic growth and development and reduces the freedoms that's inherited to our society. And in the land business, highest and best use concept is the most important thing that we look at in terms of valuation and utilization. So that's the statement from the National Association of Realtors. And just one more, and I'll get off of this and let you pick it up if I may, Brian. But Wikipedia, property rights is a theoretical socially enforced construction economics determined on how a resource or economic good is used and owned. Resources can be owned by and hence be the property of individuals, associations, collectives, or government. Property rights can be viewed as the attribute of the economic good. This attribute has four broad components and is often referred to as bundle of rights, which is part of our real estate education. We talk about bundle of rights, which is the right to use the good, the right to earn income from the good, the right to transfer the good to others, alter it, abandon it, or destroy it, or the right of ownership cessation, the right to enforce property rights. So with that, what's been going on in Oregon?
Well, that's a big question. So
okay.
In Oregon, back in 1973, we had a state Senate bill, Senate Bill 100, which was enacted, and put a very onerous land use system into place, and it has only grown more onerous with time as our government has continued to, add more regulations, put more restrictions on what we do with our properties. In Oregon, one of the main concepts is an urban growth boundary, and all cities had to create an urban growth boundary, which creates an artificial restriction of supply of urban type of properties. It also minimizes the amount of transitional properties available. So in the long run, we come back to Econ 101, and when you're putting a bunch of restrictions on property rights and what you can do and when you can do it and how long it takes to do it, you end up with not enough supply. And if you're in a, positive environment, positive lifestyle like most of Oregon, the demand component just overrides our ability to create a supply of houses. That echoes out into the industrial, the retail, the rural world, in that we can't build homes outside of urban growth boundaries except in certain circumstances. The intent was to protect our farm and forest lands, which is a very, noble goal, and we are doing it very well. The flip side of that is it's expensive to live here, and we just, as a real estate broker, it is an issue you have to deal with almost daily here in Oregon.
Right. How does that affect the value? I would think it would make it increase the land value. Because of the limited supply, obviously, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so when you look at typical growth rates or appreciation values in homes, and you put the positive locations in Oregon, like Bend, where I live, and Portland, there just is not enough housing opportunities, and typically it's going up much higher the national averages on an annual year-over-year basis.
Since property rights define the theoretical and legal ownership of resources and how they can be used in many countries, including the United States, individuals generally exercise private property rights, or the rights for a private person to accumulate, hold, or delegate, rent, and sell the property. So that's one of the base laws. What was some of the initial restrictions they put on back in 71 when they started this?
So essentially, they picked out the urbanized areas. They drew a line around them and essentially said, this is where you're going to build homes. The ability to go out in the country, buy a 40-acre parcel, split it into 10 acres, has all been made subject to overreaching land use laws that set minimum lot size requirements, set requirements if you're going to put a dwelling on a farm that you have to make enough money to justify it being a farm, and it's based upon a lot of different issues like soil types. And unfortunately, it was done in a way that anything that wasn't put in an urban growth boundary almost got defaulted into farm or forest uses, which are extremely restrictive from an ability to build a home or develop anything other than trees and agricultural products.
Wow. Our guest today is Brian Meese. This is Let's Talk Land. Brian, are the property rights in our Constitution?
Basically, our property rights began back in England, and the basis of our property rights system was brought to America. Ultimately, many of those covenants and ideas were built into our Constitution. The Fifth Amendment, as you mentioned, protects our right to allow people to own properties. They protect our ability to own those properties, to use those properties, or to dispose of those properties. So what's going on in Oregon after Senate Bill 100 in 1973 is Oregon slowly starts chipping away at your property rights by limiting what you can do. And a lot of that is in rural Oregon simply because of the housing issue, and they don't allow excessive housing to go in to the rural lands.
Is that based off of population or demographics?
Not really based off of, it's based off of mapping, and where back in 1973 where people were living and where the cities were. And part of that problem is that once those lines were drawn, it was built into the system that every 5 years they needed to go back and decide, you know, inventory their lands and decide whether they needed more.
Right.
Well, the state has stuck their nose into that situation, and it's taken the city of Bend, where I'm at. We started an urban growth boundary expansion in 2004, and it wasn't until 2016 until that was approved at the state level. And today, we are still without a shovel in the ground in any of the new 2,300 acres that was bought into the city of Bend, simply because we don't have the infrastructure. So it becomes a very long process to get from a rural parcel through a transition into an urban situation where there's enough infrastructure and the land use laws actually allow you to deal with it. So,
sounds like slow walking to me. Sounds like slow walking to me.
It is extremely slow moving through the process here. The neighbors have as much power or control over your property at times as you do. There is no limitation to your neighbor's right to appeal. So if they don't like what you're doing, they can appeal, and they can take you all the way to the Supreme Court of Oregon. And, you know, that is definitely infringing upon a property owner's rights.
Yeah, I'd say.
Kind of goes back to the NIMBY situation, where we have enough new people moving in, and then the next guy that comes in, everybody's going to gang up against them if they try to do something that they don't like. So it does create some stress.
I'd say. Brian, have you been directly involved in any of these?
Oh, yeah. I was active on the original residential land study for the city of Bend that started in 2004. I represented the realtors on that process for all 12 years. It was appealed, taken to the state level. The state level, which is the Land Development Conservation Department, which they don't do any development in that. It's just conservation and obstruction of economics. So those people step in and have the right to shut us down on a city level. And so then it went back to the city council and ultimately went back to the state. And 12 years later, we get an expansion of an urban growth boundary. And now we're sitting here 3 years later with nothing, you know, nothing has happened on any of the new lands that were brought in. simply because the land use laws don't allow you to develop if you don't have the infrastructure.
Right.
And again, you have to go through the process to get the infrastructure there.
Yeah, it sounds like a round circle. You know, in our area, we have, for example, the little town that I live in, Pilot Mountain, we have a population of about 1,280, and we are incorporated. And in North Carolina, for example, they allow the incorporated municipality to have what's called an ETJ, extraterritorial jurisdiction. And that's sometimes 1 mile, sometimes 2 miles, could be 3 miles, where the jurisdiction has the zoning rights for that area, although it's not incorporated into the city limits, for future growth and planning. And, of course, in order to get the expansion in Pilot, I know we several times have done the study on being able to annex this part of these ETJ areas around the city, but we don't have enough rooftops and enough income to justify the infrastructure. So in our area, in order to incorporate an area, we have to provide services, water, sewer, police, and fire, and rescue. And of course, if you look at the cost of infrastructure, you know, it could be 90% of the cost is for septic and 10% is for water. Water, putting in water lines, they can run up and down hills. But for septic systems, you have to have pump stations or what's called lift stations in the lower lying areas to pump up and down the hills. And those things can get very expensive, $150,000, $300,000 just for one station. So when you start running all the numbers for expansion, if you don't have enough potential taxable income in the areas that you're wanting to annex, then, you know, we haven't been able to expand in all these years for that particular reason. A little bit different concept. It's not land use, but in a way it is. But it's called extraterritorial jurisdiction.
So in Oregon, kind of paralleling that, once we have an urban growth boundary, that urban growth boundary is supposed to be have enough land in it to last for the next 20 years. And then on top of that, we're supposed to have a 50-year line outside of that, which would be available for future expansions.
Right.
We, you know, just timeline-wise, we started in 2004. We're now 2019. We should have started two more urban growth boundary reviews since we started the first one in 2004. So obviously we're falling backwards. The number, I believe, for like Portland over the last many years, they're like 23,000 housing units short for what they've needed to support the growth that's happened in Portland. The same sort of thing is happening here. When I arrived here in 1981 in Central Oregon, Bend had a population of 17,000. Today it's pushing 100,000. So the growth and the change and the traffic issues and all of the urbanization issues, you know, they all get cramped, they all get stressed.
So what's the solution? Or is there one?
Less government?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just you can't, you know, there is definitely a correlation, you know, between our rising home prices and our unaffordability issue and our homelessness issue. Portland is turning as bad as L.A., Seattle, San Francisco as far as the homelessness because of the lack of housing. And there's various affordable housing comes in various sizes. And, you know, there's a lot of people that have jobs that can't find housing. And obviously those without jobs can't find housing.
Right.
So it is becoming a crisis. If you see what the clips on TV about the lifestyle and the tents living in San Francisco, same things happening in Portland. And if you look at all these areas, one way or the other, their housing supply is being restricted. whether it's L.A., San Francisco. San Francisco's been so expensive, nobody has been able to afford homes there, you know, with a normal, you know, wage salary for years. And the same thing is unfortunately creeping into, you know, the west side of Oregon.
Wow. I don't know what to say about that. I don't know. I don't know what the solution is. I mean, I'm not the one.
I mean, it just. I mean, I'll go back to Econ 101. Well, somehow we need to loosen up the rules so that the supply side of this can be addressed. One of the things that the state of Oregon has done here recently, last year specifically, was to blanket. Make a declaration at the state level that any single-family residential neighborhood has to allow up to fourplexes in that neighborhood. So that sounds like, well, that's a great way to add units, but it isn't if you're already living in there and expect it to be a single-family neighborhood.
Right.
So the minute you start overlaying this onto existing neighborhoods, you have all the neighbors throwing a fit. Because they don't want a fourplex put in next to their, you know, little McMansion. So it just, you know, unfortunately it comes with conflict. You know, and the minute the government starts pushing this way, and the minute they push, they get an unwanted response.
So. How active are the realtors involved in this process?
The realtors, as you know, we have very active and very efficient political action committees. We are active in this at the state level. We're active at the local level. And we work hand in hand with the Builders Association throughout the state to try to bring some common sense to this whole process. To help deal with the unaffordability, and Oregon has affordability issue of major consequences because of our restricted supply.
Right, and this has got to affect your industrial growth too. I mean, you know, if Amazon wanted to come in and put a plant, just as an example, and hire 25,000 people in Portland or Bonn, I mean. They're probably not going to come there because of these laws, right? I mean, because they got to have.
Yeah, you put a layer. You know, there's a tax issue which we haven't even talked about. But you can't, if you wanted an Amazon to come to Bend, it couldn't happen because we don't have the land. We do not have the land that's zoned for Amazon. What we do have on some of our outlying cities, Prineville, Redmond, they're all open for business. Whereas for most part, because of our lack of inventory, Bend is very stifled. It's impacting our ability to, represent buyers and sellers because of the lack of inventory. We have many more buyers than we have sellers, and that dynamic just drives prices up, and you get to a point where people just can't afford homes.
What's like an average home price in your city?
We're in over 400,000 someplace.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably.
And if you put it on the market, you probably sell it in 24 hours with multiple offers.
So if you don't want people,
you know, obviously, every product is unique.
Yeah.
So every property is unique.
Sure.
So with those exceptions, yeah, if you have a good property priced right, it's going to sell immediately. Same thing with the industrial world, as you mentioned, because of our lack of land, nothing transitioning into industrial spaces. It's very tight, for any kind of affordable industrial space. Same thing is going on there. Rent rates and values are climbing out of the roof.
Amazing. Well, such a beautiful state.
Well,
it's And it's not yours. Like I said, you know, we have these laws in all 50 states in various degrees. I don't know of anything like what we're talking about today. This morning is in any of the areas that I'm familiar with, at least on this side of the Mississippi. But, you know, it seems like you got to break that log jam somehow.
Doubt about it. I mean, the in addition to the pricing and the lack of affordability, you also start seeing, you know, some economic and, you know, racial segregation issues. For example, here in Bend, the west side of Bend near downtown and the river and the Mount Bachelor, which is a ski resort, it's grown into be the hot spot, heavy gentrification, very expensive. And then you go to the east side and you have a little more space, you have more production homes, and it just creates a divide between the socioeconomic people within the city.
Our guest today is Brian Meese.
I'm
sorry, I got to interrupt us. Our guest today is Brian Meese. This is Let's Talk Land.
So, Brian, we were talking about property rights. Now let's talk about water rights. What's going on with water rights in Oregon?
So, water's for fighting, whiskey's for drinking, and Oregon's a perfect indication or perfect example of that situation. So, one story is about the spotted frog here in Central Oregon. Many of you have probably heard about the spotted owl 10 or 20 years ago that basically killed our timber industry. And that was pretty much fake science at that time, as history has provided. Today, we have a spotted frog that is requiring our irrigation companies to totally rethink and rebuild their water supply systems in order to keep our reservoirs and lakes high enough and riparian areas wet enough for this little frog to live. So Central Oregon Irrigation District is one of my clients. They, along with several other Central Oregon irrigation companies, are having to pipe miles and miles, dozens of miles of irrigation canals in order to cut down on the evaporation and leakage in order to save water for the frog. This gets into water rights history in Oregon, where rights are based upon age of those water rights. So an 1888 water right is going to be much more valuable than a 1967 water right. And unfortunately, some of our most productive areas have the junior water rights. So this frog is forcing all the irrigation companies to work together to utilize our water resources more efficiently, which is very positive. But again, you get down to, you know, where is the science on this particular environmental issue? And that's what's driving that project and those issues in Oregon, is the environmental attacks, whether it be a spotted owl, which destroyed our timber industry, or now we're dealing with a spotted frog, which is taking hacks out of the agricultural community here in Central Oregon. Similar issues, you know, are happening throughout the state. The Klamath River down in southern Oregon, they've pretty much stripped many of the farmers down there their water rights in order to save unknown species of chubs and carp and, you know, bottom fish. So this is not just a Central Oregon issue. We also have been through navigability issues with our rivers. So if you're happen to have property on a river, in the old days, your property went to the center line and you could keep people off of your banks. Today, the government, in all its wisdom, like the John Day River that borders our little ranch. We now have to deal with all of the trespassing and issues of people coming onto the property without permission, leaving their garbage, et cetera, behind. And, you know, it just, again, we have government sticking their nose into things that were going along pretty well until we start getting these environmental pressures to use these resources for more public and not private uses. So that's just a little shot at Oregon's water issues.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm not even sure what to say about that.
You got to come up with something.
Well,
like dadgum.
Well, the thing I don't understand is they're talking about, because I'm sitting here looking at this spotted frog thing, and they're saying that it's come about because of urban development. But that's totally in opposition to what we've been talking about, because there isn't any new development. So I think we're blaming maybe something natural. I don't know. I'm perplexed.
Are you pondering this?
I'm perplexed.
Yeah. Well, and it is. I mean, it is it's a country issue, and there is no real correlation to what's going on in the city of Bend with these frogs. They're all up in the mountains around our lakes and reservoirs. So it's just, you know, it is an environment. It's not really the frog. It's an environmental ploy to slow down development, to tie up our water rights for other uses than private property rights.
So when you go list a farm or vacant land in the rural areas, and one of the things, part of your due diligence, and for a buyer also, is you want to know the history of the water rights, right? I mean, that's an important disclosure, isn't it, and the effects of the status of it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, like I said, water rights are, you know, valued here based upon the age. You need to know exactly what the water rights are. Make sure if they haven't been used for 5 years, you potentially lose them. So there's a lot of little water law issues that fit into this entire, you know, discussion of property rights and land use.
So if you've got a piece of ground, I'll just use 100 acres, for example, okay, that has no internal water or even riparian water versus 100 acres maybe right down the road that has a stream course or water course or river course, or, you know, what's the difference in the value of those two properties, assuming they're basically the same, maybe agricultural land?
Well, I'm not sure about your country, but anything on the water here, whether it's creek, lake, or a river, is, you know, going to be significantly more valuable. The flip side of that is if you have a riparian area or floodplain and you want to develop it, then you're going to have to deal with all those environmental issues and potentially, you know, Bureau of Reclamation, you know, the Water Resource Department, DEQ, to lay out a plan to maintain that wetland or riparian area. So although it's pretty and it adds to the aesthetic value, it can be problematic when it comes to developing, because once if that wetland or floodplain runs through the middle of your property, then you got to figure out how to do it in two pieces. So it just, you know, it's just another government regulation.
Yeah. So as a land broker, you really have to, you may not take a listing because it's got too many issues. Because it's going to limit the number of buyers, obviously. It's going to affect the price, and it's going to take longer to probably market and sell, which is cost, right?
Correct. No doubt about it.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about your wonderful state. It's kind of fun. I was doing some research. It said humans have inhabited the area now known as Oregon for at least 15,000 years. And the record history mentioned in the land date as early as the 16th century, And during the 18th and 19th centuries, the European powers and later the United States quarreled over possession of the region until 1846 when the U.S. and Great Britain finalized division of the region. I didn't know Great Britain was involved in that. That was interesting. Oregon became a state February 14th, 1859, and as of 2005, is home to over 4 million residents. That's 2015 stats. So 4 million is not a huge, huge population for a state. So sounds like a lot of vacant land out there.
Well, we got a lot of land, but like we talked about, you know, a lot of it's out in the country, and a lot of it's locked up under land use laws that are going to try to keep it as a forest or as agriculturally productive land. So just talking a little bit about Oregon in general, we have a beautiful coastline on the Pacific Ocean, which takes up the entire west strip of the state, and then we have the Willamette Valley in southern Oregon in the middle western section, which is the wet, rainy part you hear about most of the time. Going south, you have some communities that are near the Northern California border, Medford, Grants Pass. Those are milder climates, a little warmer. Here in Central Oregon, where I live, we are right on the cusp of the Cascade Mountains, on the east side of the Cascade Mountains, on the high desert. Our elevation here in Bend is around 3,100 feet. 150 miles north on the Columbia River, where our little family ranch is and our family homesteads were, that elevation is somewhere between 200 feet elevation on the river, Columbia River, and up to maybe 1,300 feet up in the higher hills where the wheatland and pasture lands are. Yes. As you go down through the Columbia Gorge back towards Portland on the north end of the state, you get into the Hood River, the Dalles, and many of those areas are cherry-producing, apple-producing, basically fruit trees, in addition to some row crops, heading towards the northeast, central, north central and northeast, you see more dry land wheat and cattle ranches, a lot of agricultural production. The Columbia River is a major thoroughfare for barges and tugs moving wheat down the Columbia River to the ports in Portland and Astoria. And bringing other goods back up into the rural areas of north central and eastern Oregon. Then you get clear to the east side of the state. It's basically a combination of a lot of basins, parts of the, you know, that flowed into the Great Basin all the way towards, you know, effectively into the Salt Lake area. Just a lot of landlocked basins. And that's where we've seen inhabitants there for, you know, 15,000 years. They've got sandals, you know, around old lakes and stuff that have been found that have been radiocarbon dated 15,000 years ago. On the Columbia River, where our little ranch is, they've radiocarboned inhabitants there at one little spot on the Columbia River where they could swim and camp 9,000 years ago. So it was pretty much native based on fishing and hunting until Lewis and Clark got there in the early 1800s. And then from then on to when Oregon became a state in 1859, it just was on a grow. One point, Wasco County, Oregon, went clear to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. It was inhabited by Shoshone Indians, and nobody wanted it. So the history goes back, you know, literally into Mexico and the origination of all the indigenous people that ended up here. So one thing that doesn't show up on a lot of discussions about Oregon is the 1855 treaties with the Native Americans that locked in their rights to fish and live their lives on reservations. Today, there's more conflict, probably because all the resources are being challenged. The salmon coming up the Columbia are overfished. We did it. They're doing it. And it's just, you know, unfortunately that our fisheries and some of those issues are, you know, not trending, you know, in a positive direction.
Right.
You know, most of Oregon lives in the Willamette Valley. Portland has a population of around 2.5 million, including Southwest Washington and surrounding cities. They drive pretty much everything that happens in Oregon, and Portland, as I mentioned, is getting very liberal, has an affordability problem, and you know, it just it's a interesting dynamic the way our population is faced, primarily in the Willamette Valley, in large cities where you have a concentration of liberal personalities. That unfortunately control what's going on in rural Oregon.
Right.
Excuse me, rural Oregon.
So, how is the economy in Oregon?
It has its ups and downs. Because of the livability and desire of people to be here, one of our positives is our workforce. Negatives is no place for the workforce to live. We also have some gross sales taxes that impact different businesses, and we have a income tax of around, I think, 9%. So I would say our tax base, our tax structure is a negative impact on our economy.
Mm. I was looking at land prices and farm prices. You know, the USDA for many years in the summer, usually July, they publish a nationwide valuation plus minus of land, farm, and cropland, farms, cropland, and pasture. And they were showing in this last one that came out in 2009 that the average farm value was about $2,500 an acre, which had increased the previous year by 2.9%. And that cropland average was about $3,080 per acre, and that was also an increase of 2.7%. And pasture land was around $750 an acre and had increased by about 3%. So you are seeing a movement in your land values. I know around 2014, when we had the commodity bust worldwide, you know, land prices dropped significantly pretty much around the country, but especially in the farm-producing areas. But it also affected our little rural area of North Carolina, too, to a smaller degree. But we're here in the last couple of years, we're also seeing our prices come back for our land values. Is that what you're seeing there, too, Brian?
So our market, kind of because of the high demand, our market didn't really drop. It just kind of plateaued at different times. Since I've been doing this, I would say in the area where I am, east of the mountains, good farm ground, irrigated farm ground, can go as high as $10,000-$15,000 an acre. Mm. Cropland, you know, it falls in that same category. Part of what's driving our values up is the recreational uses. We have great hunting and fishing opportunities. Any rural land that has elk or deer, wildlife, and can create some sort of an economic return is very desirable. We have ranches that will compare to, you know, some of the best high mountain ranches in Colorado or Montana. Typically, they're not quite as big as some of those big ranches, but... Right. The amenities and the recreational values are becoming very significant. So it gets harder and harder to make these larger agricultural properties economically viable. You pretty much have to go to some sort of a recreational diversification to justify the numbers, you know, because you're going to pay $1,000 an acre, you know, for 5 to 10,000 acres, just for, you know, mountain pasture land. And really what they're after is the elk and the deer.
Right. What's your favorite type of land to sell? What do you enjoy the most?
So because of my, I range, you know, between the rural world and the urban world. Because of my commercial work, I do a lot of investment property and investment properties. I love the Realtors Land Institute phrase that under all is the land, because I believe that when it gets right down to it, you know, because of the land use laws, because of the individual type of uses, because of the soils, because of the ability to get water, all those things impact what you can do with it. And it doesn't matter if you're selling an industrial condo in Bend or you're selling a ranch out in the Ochoco Mountains, it's really all about the land. And from there, these other land use and property rights issues we've been talking about dictate what you can do with it. But if you don't understand what's underneath, it's very hard to understand what you can do with it or what the future of what you've done to it might be. So one of the issues that happens with our land use laws is the opportunity to make viable economic moves on transition properties where you're moving from a rural to more urban uses is very limited, and it takes a long timeline in order to get from point A to point B. So out in the country, in the city, it doesn't matter where you are in Oregon, land values are going up.
Well, we're seeing that pretty much across the United States.
Yeah.
That's one of the benefits of owning property.
Yeah, exactly. It's really the, I always say it's the best investment God ever gave us. And in fact, in the Bible, you know, there were three land transactions.
I'll give you one.
Go ahead.
Give you one more quote from Will Rogers: "Buy land, they aren't making any more of it."
Right.
So.
And if you know the direction people are going, get there before they do and buy land. That's one of my favorites.
Well, that's why you need a good broker.
That's right. And speaking of that, the Realtors Land Institute, we are the brokers, the land folks. Our website's www.rliland.com. And on there, you can peruse the 50 states and actually outside of, and you can identify the members of RLI and also the accredited land consultants. We've got a incredible website that if you're looking to move out to Oregon, we hope you call our good friend Brian Meese, and he can probably help you anywhere in the state or at least refer you to someone that knows what they're doing, and that's important. People don't realize how complicated land is. I know in my teaching, I have the only CE class devoted to land in the state of North Carolina, and I don't think there's another state that actually has one for the realtors to do their continuing education programs. And, you know, they throw a slide up. Teresa saw it not too long ago when she was working on her brokers, one of the 30-hour classes, and it says, "Land is the most complicated of all real estate transactions." But the instructor stands there and kind of says, Teresa says, "Well, why is that?" And they said, "Well, it just is." Because, unfortunately, they don't get a lot of education either. So, I know you've been a part of the Realtors Realtors Land Institute. What's been your experience?
Well, I believe firmly in the Realtors Land Institute and what they do. My ALC designation is probably the most powerful of all the designations I've received over my years. It's a small group. It's tight-knit. We all have a common conference once a year and meeting the Lou Jewels and the other land brokers from all around the country and actually all around the world.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll be in San Antonio, Texas, coming up at the end of March. So I'll be there, and I know you're going to be there as well. I got to have to come 2 days early because I have to sit through the instructor's certification program for 2 days to keep my certification so I can teach the land 101 class. But I enjoy that as well. I always love being around my land buddies, and they are like family. We're very close-knit, and we'll help each other. It's crazy, you know, I hear quite frequently or over the years about the residential brokers, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but they're quite competitive. And well, maybe some people we've got shout of here. Anyway, we've got our doggies here, dog eat dog. But the land folks, we just help each other unconditionally. I don't know. And I do consulting all over the country. And I always use an ALC if I can find one, but definitely a member of RLI to help me. If they can, at least put me in the right direction. So, you know, it's quite a unique group, and glad to be part of it. And glad to have folks like you, Brian, involved.
Well, it's fun because we're all across the country, and at the same time we have that common, you know, interest. And like you said, there doesn't seem to be any reason not to help each other. So it's just a nice group, and all over the country, so yep. It seems to be the same energy.
Yeah, and our education is second to none. Not only our course structure, but even at the land conferences, you know, the 3 days we're there, it's just full of breakouts and some of the top people with the most current things that's going on in our market to help us. I mean, every time I go to one, I come back and I make more money. I don't know how that works, but it seems to work every time. So it's a good thing.
Well, you're making people happy.
You got it. So with about a minute left, give us your last words, and then we'll let you do your commercial. How they get in touch with you, your website, your phone number, and give us your last words here.
So after all that negative about land use,
I know. Sorry
and
about
property
that.
Rights in Oregon, it's a beautiful place. There's a lot of opportunity here. You just have to work to find it. I personally, my territory is central and eastern Oregon, the heart of Oregon, if you might. Again, this is Brian Meese. I'm an ALC, CSIM. I'm a principal broker in Oregon with Remax Key Properties. My cell number is 541-480-1630. You can reach me at brian@realoregon.com. That's R-E-A-L, Oregon.com. And our office is located downtown Bend, Oregon. And we look forward seeing you walk in the door.
I look forward to seeing you, and work on getting me out there to teach one of the Land 101 class. I'd love to come out there. I've never been in that part of the world. It'd be quite.
So we got a fishing trip we're going to be donating, you know, auctioning off down there in
Cowboy Auction. Yeah, cool.
For next summer, for 4 guys to come up and fish with us. So we got a lot of fun recreational stuff to do up here.
All right. So stay with me. Thank you for joining us today. Let us know how you like the show. If you have any guests or topics you'd like to suggest, we'd appreciate them. All questions are welcome, and all of our guests may be emailed with your questions or concerns as well. This show is for the public, but most importantly for real estate agents who do not have a source for land education. All our shows after their broadcast today will be downloaded on the master website, which is www.letstalkland.net, no apostrophe, letstalkland.net. .net on Podbeam and also downloaded on Spotify. My email is lou@mylandpro.com. My cell number is 336-669-1405. Teresa, how do they get in touch with you?
My name is Teresa Martin with Sutton Properties. My phone number is 336-209-2937. My email is teresa.mylandpro@gmail.com.
So, Rodney?
Yeah.
How do they get in touch with us here at the station?
Well, they can go to our website, Lou. They can go to WKTE1090.com, and also they can download the Simple Radio app to hear us all throughout the world.
What about the universe?
Yes, that too.
Really?
Yes.
It goes everywhere, right?
Everywhere.
And we're beaching oldies, and yes. we've been nominated 5 years in a row. Right?
That's true. That's true, Lou. And we only play happy music.
Only happy music.
Yeah, everybody's going down the road being happy.
Yeah, it's a happy music station.
That's right. Only way.
24/7.
Yep.
You got it.
World Wide Web.
Right. And you got a real nice award not too long ago.
Yeah, last year, 2019 Reader's Choice Award for the Announcer of the Year.
Wonder why.
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it? You might be up for it.
Oh, I don't know. No, maybe Teresa or Shadow.
Yeah, okay.
Shadow might get one.
That's right,
Shadow. They should give a doggy award.
Yeah, I hear Shadow got some kind of award there, president of something there that we was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
It's all over the news.
Yeah, it is. Shadow Inc.
You liked that, didn't you, Teresa?
Yeah, hey, guys, thanks for listening to our show, and stay tuned for Dr. Barbie.